All right, listeners, buckle up, because today we're taking a deep dive into the wild world of corporate takeovers.
You know, the high-stakes game of mergers and acquisitions.
Exactly, and we're focusing on a case that's practically legendary in the legal world, Moran v. Household International.
Yes, a classic.
You've probably heard the term poison pill before.
At least in passing, right?
But today, we're going way beyond the surface.
Deep, deep, deep.
We're going to untangle the mechanics, the legal arguments, the lasting impact.
The whole shebang.
Imagine for a second you're on a company's board of directors. It's the 1980s. The takeover frenzy is at its peak. And your company is looking, well, vulnerable.
Like a sitting duck.
What do you do?
What do you do?
That's the dilemma at the heart of Moran v. Household.
It's a real nail biter.
It really is. And speaking of nail biting, what was it like back then?
The 1980s, man. The level of aggression in the corporate world was off the charts.
Really?
It was cutthroat. You know, it wasn't just about competition. It was about survival.
Survival of the fittest, huh?
Exactly. And one of the most feared tactics back then was the two-tier tender offer.
I've heard of those. Those sound kind of shady.
Well, they were designed to be pretty aggressive. Basically, a raider would offer a premium price, you know, to entice shareholders, snag a controlling stake in the company.
Yeah, man.
And then they'd squeeze out the remaining shareholders at a much lower price.
Ouch.
Yeah. Not a fun situation to be in if you were one of those left holding the bag.
So companies were understandably terrified of these two-tier tender offers.
Oh, absolutely. They were scrambling for ways to protect themselves.
Enter Household International, right?
Right. Now, Household International wasn't about to just sit around and wait to be targeted.
So they took matters into their own hands.
They did. They decided to get proactive. And they crafted this ingenious defense mechanism we now know as the poison pill.
Officially called the Rights Plan, I believe.
Right, the Rights Plan. It was a bold move.
So let's break this Rights Plan down. How did it actually work? Paint us a picture.
Okay, so picture this. You're a corporate raider.
I'm feeling ambitious already.
And you've got your eye on Household International. You start buying up shares, feeling pretty smug.
Like a shark circling its prey.
Exactly. But then, boom, you hit that 20% ownership threshold.
Uh-oh.
Or maybe you get bold and launch a tender offer for 30% of the company.
And then the trap is sprung.
You got it. The Rights Plan kicks in.
So what happens? Does some alarm bell go off in the boardroom?
Not quite, but the effect is pretty dramatic. Suddenly, every other shareholder...
Except the raider.
Except you, the unwelcome suitor.
Right.
They get the right to buy a ton of discounted stock.
A ton.
A whole bunch, yeah. And this instantly dilutes your ownership stake.
Makes that takeover a lot more expensive.
And a whole lot less appealing. It's like suddenly hitting a wall.
So the idea is to make it so costly for the raider that they just give up.
Exactly. It's like flooding the market with cheap shares. And just to make things even more fun...
There's more.
There's this little thing called the flip-over provision.
Ominous. Tell me more.
So let's say the company is acquired, despite the poison pill.
Against all odds.
Well, these rights, they magically transform. They convert into shares of the acquirer's stock.
Talk about a plot twist.
And that could potentially cripple the raider financially.
It's a brilliant defense mechanism, I have to admit. But I'm guessing not everyone was thrilled with this strategy.
You're right about that. Enter John Moran.
Our dissenting voice.
John Moran wasn't just some random shareholder. This guy was a director at Household International and the chairman of DKM, their largest shareholder at the time.
So he had some serious skin in the game.
Oh, yeah. And he was deeply concerned about this rights plan. Deeply. His argument was that it gave management too much power.
Too much power to do what?
To resist takeovers.
Even potentially beneficial ones.
Even those, yeah. And that, he argued, could ultimately harm shareholder interests, you know, the very people they're supposed to be protecting.
So we've got this clash of perspectives. The board trying to safeguard the company. And Moran arguing for shareholder rights. What happened next?
Well, this dispute, as you might expect, ended up in court.
Where else would it go?
Right. And not just any court. This case went all the way to the Delaware Supreme Court.
The big leagues.
The Chancery Court initially sided with Household, but Moran, he wasn't giving up that easily.
He appealed.
And that's how it landed in the Delaware Supreme Court.
Okay, so now we're in the legal weeds. This is where things get a little tricky for those of us who aren't lawyers. We're talking about the Delaware General Corporation Law, right?
Got it.
Fiduciary duties.
Yep.
The business judgment rule.
All of it.
Enough to make the average person's head spin.
It's a lot to unpack.
So let's try to break it down. What were the key legal questions at the heart of this case?
Well, the first question revolved around the board's authority.
Authority to do what, exactly?
To issue stock rights like they did with the rights plan.
Moran didn't think they had that power.
Right. Moran argued that this power was very specific, you see. Limited to certain situations.
Like corporate financing?
Yeah, things like that.
But the board?
The board, of course, claimed they had much broader authority, you know, to act in the best interests of the company.
And what about the business judgment rule? Where did that fit into all of this?
Ah, the business judgment rule. Now, this is a big one. This rule basically gives boards a lot of leeway.
Leeway to do what?
To make decisions. It basically presumes that directors are acting in good faith, that they're not being reckless.
They've done their due diligence.
Right, that they're informed, that they're acting in the best interests of the company.
So the court isn't going to second guess every decision they make.
Unless there's some clear evidence of, you know, bad faith or gross negligence.
Okay, so that's a pretty significant protection for the board. So basically, if they could show they weren't just acting out of self-interest.
Yeah, if they could demonstrate that they genuinely believed this rights plan was the best way to protect the company.
They were in the clear.
Pretty much.
And remember, this is all done preemptively.
Right. Right. Household put this plan in place before there was a specific threat on the table. No hostile takeover looming. And that was huge. I mean, that played a major role in how the court analyzed everything.
So the court really took that into consideration.
Absolutely. It was a key factor.
So tell me, what was the Delaware Supreme Court's verdict? Did they buy Moran's argument or did they side with the board?
Well, get ready for this because this is a pivotal moment in corporate law. The Delaware Supreme Court. They sided with Household.
No way.
Oh, yeah. They upheld the rights plan.
Wow. That's huge.
It sent shockwaves through the corporate world.
It must have.
Yeah.
So they essentially gave the green light to poison pills.
They did.
That seems like it would have massive implications for how companies operate.
It absolutely did. The court essentially said that boards, you know, they have broad authority when it comes to issuing stock rights.
But there must be some limits, right?
Of course. There are limits. As long as those rights, you know, they don't step on shareholders' fundamental rights.
Like their voting rights.
Exactly. Voting rights, economic rights, things like that.
So as long as shareholders aren't completely stripped of their power.
The board has the right to deploy these defensive measures.
Yeah.
Essentially, yes. But the court, they didn't stop there. They went deep, deep into the business judgment rule.
What did they say about that?
They emphasized how diligently the household board had acted.
What do you mean?
They sought advice. They talked to investment bankers. Legal counsel, all before enacting the rights plan.
They really did their homework.
They did. They showed a clear effort to make an informed decision, a reasonable decision.
So it wasn't just a knee-jerk reaction.
Not at all. They really thought this through.
That's a critical point. They had to demonstrate that careful consideration.
Absolutely. And here's where it gets even more interesting, even more nuanced.
The layers.
The court, you see, they drew a distinction.
Between what and what?
Between approving a plan proactively, like Household did,
okay,
and using it defensively against a specific takeover bid that was already on the table.
So there's a difference.
A big one. They acknowledge that if a board uses a poison pill in response to a specific offer, well, that triggers a whole different level of scrutiny, a much higher level.
So having a poison pill ready to go is one thing.
But actually using it is a whole other ballgame.
What happens if a company does try to use a poison pill to block a specific takeover attempt? What happens then? Does that change things legally?
Oh, it definitely raises the stakes. The court actually referenced a previous case, the Inocol case.
I've heard of that one.
And Inocol established a much tougher standard of review when boards take defensive actions like that in those situations. The board really has to prove their case.
What do you have to prove?
They have to demonstrate that they had a good reason to believe the takeover was a real threat to the company, a genuine threat.
Okay.
And that their response was proportional to that threat.
So no scorched earth tactics allowed.
Exactly. No overkill. The court made it clear any defensive measures have got to be reasonable, proportionate to the perceived threat. They can't be overly aggressive or draconian.
I love that word. Draconian.
Right. It's perfect in this context.
So they can't do something that would unfairly harm shareholders.
Right. Or the market.
It seems like the courts are trying to walk a very fine line here.
They are.
Giving boards the power to protect themselves.
Yes.
but also making sure they don't abuse that power.
It's a delicate balance.
So they can't just entrench themselves or unfairly disadvantage shareholders.
Exactly. And the Moran decision, you know, it didn't just settle this one legal dispute.
It did a lot more than that.
It established a framework.
Right.
For how companies should approach these defensive tactics.
Yeah.
And later cases like Unitrin built on that framework.
They added more layers.
Fewer layers of scrutiny.
To make sure these tactics are used responsibly.
Precisely.
So Moran v. Household, in a way, it unleashed this whole new era of corporate strategy.
It did.
Made poison pills a commonplace defense mechanism.
Commonplace, yeah.
But this can't be a one-sided story, right?
Yeah.
There must be some downsides to giving boards this much power.
There are.
What's to stop them from just saying no to every offer?
Right.
Even if it would benefit shareholders. Even if it was a good deal.
That's the million-dollar question, and it's a debate that's still raging today.
A debate worth having. So let's dive into that debate.
Let's do it.
What are the arguments on both sides?
Well, on the one hand, you have the argument that poison pills give boards leverage.
Leverage to do what?
Leverage to negotiate.
Negotiate better deals.
Better deals, yeah. To protect companies and potentially their shareholders from being taken over on unfavorable terms. It's like having a no trespassing sign on your company's front lawn.
To kick it out.
Exactly. It forces potential acquirers to, you know, come to the table, engage in meaningful discussions, rather than just launching a hostile takeover with a lowball offer.
I can see the logic in that. It gives boards more control over their destiny.
It does.
But what about the other side?
Well, on the other hand, you have this concern about entrenchment.
Entrenchment?
Yeah, critics worry that boards might use poison pills to, you know, cling to power.
Just to keep their jobs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Rejecting even good offers, good for shareholders, that is.
Just to protect their own positions.
And potentially depriving shareholders of premium prices for their shares. It's this tension, this constant tension between, you know, management's desire for control.
And shareholders' desire for maximum value.
Right.
It's a tough balancing act, isn't it?
It really is.
So let's step back for a second. We've been talking about this legal battle, these high stakes corporate maneuvers. But how does all of this actually impact, you know, someone like me, someone who isn't navigating boardrooms and billion-dollar deals every day?
That's where things get really interesting. You know, it's funny you should say that because it really does kind of feel like one of those choose-your-own-adventure books, right?
It does.
Like, you reach a certain point and
bam! Fork in the road.
Suddenly, there are multiple paths you could take, and the story changes depending on your choice.
Well, in this case, the path was determined by the Delaware Supreme Court, right?
Exactly.
And they made a pretty significant choice.
They did, and it's one that still resonates in the business world today.
So spill the beans. What was their decision?
All right, drum roll, please. The Delaware Supreme Court ultimately sided with Household International.
Whoa, hold on. So they actually upheld the poison pill.
They did. They said it was a legitimate defense tactic.
Wow. I bet that sent shockwaves through the corporate world.
Oh, absolutely. This wasn't just a ruling on a single case. It was a landmark decision that set a precedent for how companies could protect themselves.
So essentially, they gave companies a powerful weapon to use in these takeover battles.
You could say that, but it's not as simple as just saying poison pills are now legal.
There's always nuance in the law, right?
Always. The court went to great lengths to explain their reasoning and to lay out the boundaries for how these defensive measures could be used.
So walk us through it. What were the key takeaways from their decision?
Okay, so first and foremost, they emphasize that a board's primary duty is to the corporation and its shareholders.
Which is kind of a core principle of corporate law, right?
Exactly. It's all about making decisions that are in the best interests of the company and its owners.
And the court felt that in this particular case, the household board had acted in good faith.
Precisely. They didn't see any evidence of self-dealing or bad faith on the part of the board members.
They genuinely believed that this rights plan was necessary to protect the company from potentially harmful takeovers.
And that was crucial because the court emphasized that they weren't going to second guess the board's business judgment as long as it was made in a reasonable and informed manner.
Which brings us back to the business judgment rule, right?
Yep. That's the legal principle that gives boards a lot of leeway in making these kinds of decisions.
As long as they can demonstrate that they acted prudently and with due care.
Right. The court really hammered home that point. They scrutinized the household board's actions, and they found that the board had been very careful.
They didn't just rush into this?
No, they consulted with experts. They got advice from investment bankers and lawyers. They weighed the pros and cons, and they ultimately came to a reasoned decision.
So it wasn't just a knee-jerk reaction to a perceived threat?
Not at all. It was a calculated move made after careful deliberation.
And that made all the difference in the court's eyes.
The court said, look, we're not going to micromanage how boards run their companies. As long as they're acting in good faith and making informed decisions, we're going to respect their judgment.
So that's a pretty significant win for boards across the country.
It basically gave them the legal backing to implement these kinds of defensive measures if they felt it was necessary to protect their companies.
But of course there are limits, right?
Of course the court wasn't giving boards a blank check to do whatever they wanted.
They laid out some ground rules.
They said that any defensive measures, like a poison pill, have to be proportionate to the threat.
So no going overboard.
Right. No scorched earth tactics allowed. You can't just nuke the company to keep it from being taken over.
The court made it clear that they would step in if they saw a board abusing its power.
Exactly. They emphasize that any defensive measures have to be reasonable and they have to be designed to protect the interests of the corporation and its shareholders.
Not just the interests of the board members themselves.
Right. It's a delicate balance, and the court made it clear that they would be watching closely to ensure that boards don't cross the line.
This is all so fascinating. I'm starting to see why Moran v. Household is considered such a landmark case.
It really is a game changer. It reshaped the landscape of corporate takeovers, and it continues to have a huge impact on how companies operate today.
And it all boils down to this fundamental question of who has the ultimate power in a corporation.
Right. Is it the board or is it the shareholders?
And how do we strike the right balance between protecting a company from hostile takeovers and ensuring that shareholders' voices are heard?
Big questions. Big implications.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground in this episode, but I feel like we've just scratched the surface.
We have. There's so much more to unpack here.
And I know our listeners are eager to hear more. So let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and delve even deeper into the implications of Moran v. Household.
It really is a rabbit hole, isn't it?
It is, but it's a fascinating one.
No, absolutely. And it's not just theoretical, you know?
What do you mean?
I mean, this stuff has real-world consequences for everyday people.
Like how?
Well, think about it. When companies merge or get acquired, it can shake things up big time.
In the stock market.
Exactly. Your portfolio could take a hit, or you could see some gains depending on how the deal plays out.
Right. A merger could send stock prices soaring.
Or plummeting.
If investors aren't happy about it.
Precisely so. Understanding these takeover battles and the tactics involved, like poison pills.
It can make you a smarter investor.
Absolutely. It helps you connect the dots between those boardroom decisions and what happens in the market.
So it's not just about legal theory. It's about real money.
It is. And that's why cases like Moran v. Household are so important. They shed light on how these high-stakes games are played.
Okay, so let's say I'm not just an investor. I'm actually on a company's board of directors.
Now we're talking.
What does Moran v. Household mean for me when I'm making decisions about mergers and acquisitions?
That's a great question, and it really gets to the heart of the matter, because Moran v. Household essentially gave boards a powerful tool, but it's a tool that comes with a lot of responsibility.
So it's like being given the keys to the kingdom.
In a way, yes, you're entrusted with making decisions that could have huge implications for the company, its employees, and its shareholders.
A little pressure.
Right. But it's not just about wielding power. It's about using it wisely and ethically.
So if my board is considering adopting a poison pill or any other defensive measure, we need to be extra careful.
Absolutely. You need to proceed with caution and make sure you're doing everything by the book.
What do you mean by the book?
I mean, you need to make sure your actions are aligned with the principles laid out in Moran v. Household and subsequent cases.
So we can't just use a poison pill to entrench ourselves and keep our jobs.
Right. You need to be able to demonstrate that you're acting in the best interests of the corporation and its shareholders, not just your own self-interest.
And how do we do that?
Documentation, my friend. Documentation.
What do you mean?
I mean keeping meticulous records of your decision-making process.
So minutes from board meetings.
Exactly. And any reports or advice you received from experts like investment bankers or lawyers.
So if our actions are ever questioned, we have a paper trail to back us up.
Precisely. It's all about transparency and accountability.
Showing that we acted in good faith. And with due care.
You want to be able to demonstrate that you considered all the relevant factors, you weighed the pros and cons, and you ultimately made a decision that was reasonable and informed.
So it's not enough to just make the right decision.
You have to be able to prove that you made it the right way.
That makes sense. So documentation is key.
It's crucial. It's your best defense against any allegations of wrongdoing.
Well, I have to say, this deep dive into Moran v. Household has been incredibly eye-opening.
I agree. It's a case that really gets you thinking about the balance of power in corporations.
And the role of the courts in overseeing that balance.
Exactly. It's a reminder that even in the world of high finance, the law matters.
And that decisions made in the boardroom can have far-reaching consequences.
For everyone.
Well said. And on that note, I think it's time to wrap up this episode of The Deep Dive.
It's been a pleasure exploring this case with you.
Likewise. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this journey into the fascinating world of corporate takeovers.
We hope you found it as insightful as we did.
And we encourage you to keep learning and keep asking questions, because the more you know about the forces that shape our economy,
the better equipped you'll be to navigate the complexities of the business world.
Until next time, stay curious
and stay informed.